I'm so excited to share with you that the doors are officially open for my first ever phone-free event that's happening in Los Angeles, California on February 28th at Mudwater Gather in Santa Monica, with the option for you to dive even deeper on March 1st. Now look, this event is about you. It's about you building connections and community and us all really bringing this analog revolution to life and reminding our hearts and souls what we truly crave most, what nourishes our being, which is co-regulating with other humans, having our mirror neurons dance together, sharing experiences together, but also learning together. So on top of all the community and connection possibilities for you, there's also an incredible lineup of speakers. I've got internationally renowned nervous system expert Sarah Baldwin, Nike master trainer Brandon Collingsworth talking about purpose and meaning, and Mandy Balak, who's the president of the Gathering Festival, which is one of the largest marketing and branding conferences in North America. So we're going to be diving deeper into what does the future look like to walk alongside technology and use technology as a tool. Now look, if you want to dive even deeper, there's limited space for a VIP dinner on the Saturday night. And if you want to go even deeper, if it's aligned for leaders, coaches, therapists, entrepreneurs, branding, marketing, whoever is called, there's a mastermind on the Sunday morning with even more limited seating. And that's going to be about what does the future look like to create in this world with technology. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, you want to find out more and save your spot, go to markgroves.com/future. I can't wait to see you there.
I think free speech has been the best tool in human history for innovation, wealth creation, understanding, and this is the least appreciated one of all.
Hi, my name is Mark Groves, and I'm obsessed with understanding human behavior and why we do what we do. In this podcast, I interview the world's most brilliant minds and hearts, where I get to explore, alongside you, every subject you can imagine relating to our human experience and how we relate. It is my deepest intention that we all learn how to create the life and love that we've always dreamt of. Now, before we get rolling, make sure you hit that subscribe button so you don't miss any episodes. And one ask that I have, and an amazing way that you can help support the podcast, is by wherever you listen to it, giving in a five-star review and a written review. With all that said, let's dive in and transform our lives. Welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today, I am joined by author, teacher, I mean, you're president of foundations, you're Greg Luke Yanov. Welcome.
Woo, thanks for having me.
I did it, right? I got the name.
Perfect, yeah.
Woo, I'm basically Russian now. I wanted to give context to the listeners of like what drew me to your work. And I've expressed a lot on the podcast about how everybody needs to read Coddling of the American Mind. When it was written, it was very important. And I feel like what you guys were onto when you wrote it, and the work that you do, it has just been exacerbated, or it seems like it's been amplified. So I'm curious what drew you to the work in working with free speech and all that kind of stuff, because you're the, is the right term, the president? You're the president and CEO of the Foundation of Individual Rights and Expression, so FIRE.
Yep.
You also have the book Unlearning Liberty, Kansas Censorship, and the End of American Debate, Freedom from Speech, and FIRE's, you also have a guide to free speech on campus. So, I mean, there's some, your work is in this space of free speech, and it seems like there's a lot of controversy about free speech. So how did you get into it?
Well, you know, I'm in a sense a sort of typical first generation American. Both my parents are immigrants. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood with a lot of other immigrant kids and first generation Americans. And one, you definitely come in with a sense of sort of like what's special about the country, which is really always reinforced by where people were coming from. My mother is Irish by way of Britain and thinks of herself as British. But my dad is Russian by way of Yugoslavia. So my grandfather fought in the Bolshevik Revolution. We were serfs who made good, sometimes dismissed as kulaks, you know, a success story in any other country and murdered by the millions by the Soviets. But my dad grew up in Yugoslavia. Those kind of experiences really make you appreciate freedom of speech. So it's something that I always kind of felt like this is something that Americans are lucky enough to take for granted. But nobody, you know, who has, you know, a history of their families dealing with authoritarians or totalitarians take it for granted. And so I was already pretty jazzed about it. Also, frankly, growing up in an environment where there were you know, the other kids, you know, in my neighborhood, they're from Peru, they're from Vietnam, they're from Korea, they're from, you know, even other parts of the United States, like Puerto Rico or the American South. Like, in that environment, free speech kind of almost automatically becomes the rule, because you can't guess what the, you know, what the things that, you know, Danny Nguyen's, you know, dad think you shouldn't say, or Nelson Bleda's mom thinks you shouldn't say. The melting pot aspect of it actually makes you automatically kind of like a little bit more pro free speech to begin with. But then I went to undergrad and I was a journalism major, and man, do you see that in action? If you try to be a journalist, they people come into your office every day to try to tell you you have to pull back this story or cancel this, even though that wasn't the word at the time.
Yeah.
You don't get rid of this journalist or this columnist. So I went to law school to specialize in First Amendment law. And I took every class at Stanford Law School offered on First Amendment. When I ran out, I interned was the word for some reason, at the ACLU of Northern California in 1999. I did 6 credits on censorship during the Tudor dynasty. So this is, you know, I feel
this
like free speech
jam.
Is why I was put on the earth.
Yeah. And well, what have you know? So in your time, so you have this passion for it based on ancestral experience of not having it, which of course I think you're right. We can take it for granted. And it's only when you don't have it anymore that you recognize the value of it. But of course, the fighting for free speech came from the lack of it. So it's interesting that we almost do these circular experiences in human history where we, you know, I think of like the after World War II and the conversation about Nuremberg and informed consent. And it seems like we just decided to suspend on some level medical ethics for the last 2 or 3 years. And now I hope that we come back to some semblance. But have you noticed this with free speech now, that there is this, because it seems like even this conversation that's going on Twitter right now, which I'm sure you're well aware of.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah. It's like, is there a line where free speech, there is something that should be censored or not allowed? And how does one determine that? I'm curious. Because if I'm offended by it, I will say I don't want people to say those things or be allowed to. But to someone else, they might be offended by what I say. So
exactly.
Of course that's true. Of course some... At the opposite of every position.
I call my blog the eternally radical idea. And what I'm getting at with that is that freedom of speech is very unusual in human history. It's actually almost always on the losing side if you look at the grand scope of history. And it was, you know, the printing press and nascent democracy movements that actually gave it this sort of popular power. And I think it's a, you know, beautiful, powerful thing. Mm-hmm. But usually I call it censorship gravity, like a black hole. We're being pulled back to, you know, the Guardian class, more or less, saying like less and less freedom of speech. And when I do something that's considered very rude in constitutional law circles, I go to Europe, and instead of saying, well, you guys have it right with all of your speech regulations and America is just foolish and one day we'll be as enlightened as you, I go, no, we actually have it right and you're doing it all wrong when it comes to free speech. But what I'm saying is not that we have some – I try to explain to them, we don't have this crazy system you think we do. We have some of the best thinkers in American law and some of the best philosophers, period, as far as I'm concerned, like people like Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis and Justice Robert Jackson, you know, talking about how do you have freedom of speech in the real world. So things like threats aren't protected, harassment's not protected, you know, incitement to imminent lawless action is not protected. When Elon Musk talked about taking over Twitter or buying Twitter, I wrote a letter saying like, listen, you're a private company. You do not have to, and nor do I advocate you should have to abide by First Amendment norms. However, there's a lot of well-thought-out standards in there that prevent you from the trap of just doing it based on your own subjective feeling and judgment of what you think is offensive. And even when I go over to Europe, I talk about the what I call the bedrock principle, which is from a Supreme Court case, that the thing that distinguishes American law more than anything else when it comes to freedom of speech in the world is we have a bedrock principle that you can't ban something simply because it's offensive. And this is something that you really learn when you grow up with genuine multiculturalism, because offensiveness is incredibly subjective and it changes
from person to
person. It changes from year to year. It's different between economic classes, genders, everything. So it's too it's too squishy. It's too malleable to base that on it. And that's the major difference. So, you know, I'm always saying it's like, listen, we have this very well thought out system that sometimes gets a bad rap because people don't understand it that well.
One, I'm curious, because I think when we advocate for free speech or the ability to express ourselves, even ways that are offensive, which I totally get what you're saying about time. It's subjective culturally. Like, I went on a medical leave once when I broke my leg. And when I came back, I hadn't been, you know, I normally played high level soccer. I came back as put on a bit of weight. And I went to a doctor's office of doctors I used to call on, customers, and they're Chinese. And she was like, "You're getting fat, Mark." And I was like, "What? Wow, good to see you. I'm healed." And I was telling one of my best friends who's Chinese, he's like, "Oh yeah, culturally we don't fuck around. Like, we'll tell you that you're fat."
My mother had the weird kind of like lower class British sort of like Irish girl kind of thing where she had this exaggerated sense of politeness. Yeah. And my dad is Russian, so he has this like exaggerated sense of honesty, and as he would say, politeness is a form of deception.
It's so funny. Well, my Croatian friend, I used to think she was very blunt. Yeah. And when she gave me context, she said, "We don't have the fluffy words you Canadians use and need." And I was like, yeah. And so culturally, there's context. Time, which of course, like you think of someone who wrote a book, like is it the Cat in the Hat guy who they wanted to cancel?
Oh, Dr. Seuss, yeah.
Right. And the Mr. Potato Head, like when they wanted to cancel because of gender. You know, because of gender assignment to Mr. Potato Head, but
sorry,
you're right. And Kevin Hart getting for tweets in 2004. Now, granted, I don't think you can take what was culturally acceptable in 1842 and put it with the same rigorous lens today. So I'm curious, because a lot of the pushback I hear to free speech is you're advocating for racism. You're advocating for to be a semi, you know, you're advocating for all these things. And I'm curious, how do you handle that one?
I think that there's been a campaign on campus started about the year after the launch of the free speech movement in Berkeley in 1964. There was I didn't realize how influential he was at the time, Herbert Marcuse, who was considered sort of the guru of the left, who wrote this piece called Repressive Tolerance, talking about in the truly equal society, we'd actually be so, we wouldn't have free speech, we'd actually go after a regressive speech, which he explicitly defined as conservative speech, as right-wing.
Interesting,
speech.
Yeah.
And it's still thinking, and I think it's a problem that we have people who still use the term liberal to mean two very different groups. And I consider myself like a libertarian lefty.
Same.
Meanwhile, there's the sort of like utopian top-down, oftentimes Marxist-inspired version of the left, which has a very different attitude. And in Europe, you just call them you just use the word socialist, which is, yeah, doesn't have the same kind of pejorative context over here that over there that does over here. What I think has happened is that after decades on campus, when you're in power or when you think people like you are likely to be in power, it makes a certain amount of cynical sense to start saying, like, actually, you know, if my people were in charge, we wouldn't just allow those awful people to talk. We'd have enlightened censorship. We'd have censorship for good.
Altruistic censorship.
And that's never the way it works out. Censorship is always an exercise of power, which is particularly funny given like the whole philosophy of a lot of the people who want less speech is that it's about power
equality.
Dynamics.
Yeah.
Without seeing their own power.
That's fascinating.
And I think that the way it gets taught to young people is this kind of like, oh, well, that's a bad idea, so we shouldn't hear it. And I'm like, no, is it valuable to know what people think always? Then free speech is always valuable. So I call this like the lab and the looking glass theory of freedom of speech, that essentially I explain like when people get to misinformation, you know,
right,
and you have an uncle that believes that lizard people who live under the Denver airport control everything. My favorite conspiracy theories.
I didn't even know that one existed. That's a good one.
It's a great one. And if you think about it from this kind of primitive way of thinking about freedom of speech, and I do really think it's a very simplistic way to think about it, that it's like, well, that's misinformation. That's a bad idea. That should be banned. And I'm like, you're misunderstanding something. Yes, that's false. Is it valuable to know that your uncle thinks that? You bet it is valuable to
yeah,
know
it is.
Even if people think crazy and dumb things, it's better to know.
Yeah, it's true. I was listening to a pod with the recent author. I forget his name, but he was talking about conspiracy theories. And essentially from a...
Oh, Michael Shermer?
That's right.
And, yeah, Sherman's a great guy.
Yeah, and how he said from an evolutionary benefit, it actually serves us often to believe the conspiracy theory more than not, because in history, when we haven't, we've been sort of hoodwinked or taken advantage of her. And so he made that as one of the arguments. And, you know, I'm Canadian, and what I've found in the last 3 years especially, but in following your work, and is that I feel like I was really naive. Like, I really feel like I thought, oh yeah, Canada would never do certain things to its people. It would never censor speech. It would never do these things. But I've certainly had my my eyes opened in terms of these conversations and how much momentum from quote unquote the left, which formerly I would have said, as you said, oh yeah, I identify with that branch of government and I would vote for that party. And I've been left with a pretty sour taste in my mouth for that party. And, you know, in speaking out against things like mandates, I was called right wing. And I'm like, wait, outside of speaking out about mandates, is there anything else I do that you define as right wing? No. So am I right wing, or is that just an ass? And what is it about the human psyche or need to put things in these categorical boxes? Because do you find in speaking out about free speech that people just automatically think you're conservative? Or right wing?
Yeah, and it's one of these things where I'm not, you know, like I have an impressive, you know, left wing pedigree from working at the ACLU. I did refugee law in Eastern Europe. I did environmental mentoring for inner city high school kids in Southeast DC, where I live now. Like, I have an almost embarrassingly sort of like lefty background. And usually when I present this now, I feel like that I want to be more direct about how I feel about presenting this stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's ridiculous that I have to sort of prove I'm not this thing to you, because then what? If I was, you wouldn't ever have to listen to me? That's the way children think.
You instantly are invaluable in your perspective, even though your expertise completely makes you very credentialed to talk about everything.
And this is one of the things I think has happened from higher ed. And I'm working on a book called, very creatively, I'm working on a book called Canceling of the American Mind.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
With a 22-year-old wunderkind, Ricky Schlott. She's an amazing young woman who I'm very lucky to be able to.
Oh, I saw you guys are doing a live podcast recording in by the time this comes out, you'll probably have already done it, but it's in New York with Jonathan and her, right?
Yeah, Jonathan, Ricky, and Scott Barry Kaufman.
That's right.
It should be. And it's at the Comedy Cellar, so apparently we're supposed to be fun.
God, I wish I could make it. I was like, oh, that's like a dream event.
It'll be on the podcast, though. It's going to be
okay, great.
He's going to be putting it on air. And so I talk about this thing that I call the perfect rhetorical fortress, is that on campus, at the same time, we're developing more of this sort of chipping away at the sort of romantic appeal that free speech had on the left, and very deliberately chipping away on it. There are also these sort of lazy argumentation tactics that should have been taught out, that should have been basically represented as just from people from K through 12 on up. Like, no, those are ad hominem arguments. Like,
yeah.
if you're saying that I don't have to listen to you because you're conservative, that's childish. That's a silly approach. But in the perfect rhetorical fortress, that's barricade number one, is that if you can label something conservative, you don't have to listen to it. And once you have a tactic like that, you shouldn't be surprised that suddenly it works, and it allows you to win arguments without actually winning arguments. Then next thing you know, Jonathan Chait is right wing. All the Harper's Letters people, you know, dismissing
where's
like the
end.
The Harper's Letter. Noam Chomsky signed on to a Harper's Letter.
Yeah.
And so, and I think people would be like, well, he's not right wing, but he is, he's right adjacent, you know. And the thing is, there's also the thing that I want to scream is like, and so what at the same time? It's like, just like, bad people are not necessarily always wrong, and good people are not always necessarily right. Even if you think I'm the devil.
That's fascinating, because I think that's also the thing that you guys have spoken about, is sort of the righteousness that goes with it, right? Like,
yeah.
There's a moralization. Like, if I have
a moral
this
certitude, which is uncertainty, and for those of us who are genuine, like old school liberals, certainty is usually the enemy.
Mm. Can you speak more to that? Like the moral did you say moral certitude?
Yeah. That essentially, I remember having a friend who couldn't really believe that I actually take great comfort in the unknowability of the universe. You know, I actually really do. It's one of the reasons why I like Buddhism. I like some aspects of Stoicism, like the ability to look at the world and just be like, in the grand scheme of things, I basically know nothing. And censorship is always an act of epistemic, which means relating to knowledge, arrogance. The reason why people cite John Stuart Mill all the time is because nobody's actually defeated his arguments yet. And one of the things he always says that the censor takes on the position of being infallible. Because if they're saying that your argument is not worth anybody hearing, it's like, how do you know that? And I've been reading some of these anti-free speech books, including by someone I actually like personally, Stanley Fish. He wrote this book called The First about the First Amendment, and it is so bad. I thought he'd learned something over his career because he did actually study First Amendment law, but he flips everything on its head by saying, well, first we have to figure out what we need free speech for in the first place, and then we decide what we censor. And if things can actually work contrary to the values that we think that free speech should be for, then we can ban it. And I'm kind of like, no. you're getting this all wrong. The default is supposed to be free speech. Like once you have something like the First Amendment, censorship is what you have to justify. And by the way, once you start justifying censorship, you realize that it doesn't even usually work very well to stop ideas from spreading. And particularly if you're trying to stop conspiracy theories, by the way, I say this a lot.
Feeds them.
If you're trying to stop someone who has a conspiracy theory that people are out to get them and silence people like them, don't do anything that looks even vaguely like a conspiracy to silence and get people like them.
Well, I think that's been the conversation about social media, now these quote unquote Twitter files are being released. And, these conversations that Twitter had with government officials at the United States, but, I doubt that Canada didn't have any conversations. And of course they all did. And when free speech, because you were saying if you're a private company, you really don't have to adhere to First Amendment law. When government is actually influencing, does that change? Because I know Alex Berenson's case, he's making that argument, and I believe suing both, I forget the guy's name, but one of the he's suing like Biden, Fauci, the White House, but he's also suing a medical person from the government too, who used to work for them. I think he's on the Pfizer board now, shocking. But I'm curious, like, how does that then impact free speech law for private companies?
Just for listeners, FIRE used to be the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and we were founded back in 99. On June 6th of 2022, we announced that we're now the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. And we focus on free speech, not just on campus anymore, but all throughout the United States. But we do one additional thing, which is we don't just talk about First Amendment free speech. We talk about free speech culture. We talk about the idea that free speech is bigger, bolder, and older than the First Amendment. And so we do a lot of considering what's going on in social media. The first Twitter file dump by Matt Taibbi, who I have a lot of respect for, we were looking to see if there was a smoking gun that the government had crossed the line into what's called state action. State action means that essentially the government has so overstepped the bounds that essentially it's making other people do things that it doesn't have the constitutional power to do. Mm. There are moments in there that it looks pretty close. We don't think it quite makes it. However, does that mean I thought that Matty Iglesias actually put it really well. It's like, okay, guys who are trying to say this is a nothing burger, imagine it being people you don't like. Imagine it being Trump and Rupert Murdoch conspiring together.
If it was about Trump, it would be.
Yeah, you'd rightfully flip out. So some of this use of power we criticize a lot. And there's been, Eric Adams said stuff about how we have to police more and censor more on social media. This is coming out of multiple senators. The Biden, Jen Psaki said things. And we're like, no, hold on. Like, you are telling a private corporation that it needs to censor things that are actually, that you can't censor yourself. That's a problem. So definitely there's a moral problem to it. There's also a hypocritical problem. problem to it, just like Matty Iglesias pointed out, that the second round that just came out, where Barry Weiss' second Twitter files, shows that all of the sort of shadow banning that people were talking about and all the delisting and all the efforts to make Jay Bhattacharya, I'm probably butchering
his name. I've interviewed
him,
yeah.
And a lot of those things that he ended up, you know, saying, he got pretty vindicated.
Pretty much right on, I would say, almost all of them.
Yeah. And that, watching Twitter suddenly, like people on Twitter being kind of like, oh, we all knew this already. I'm like, no. People were saying, it's the same thing with cancel culture, where it's kind of like, I've been hearing from Twitter experts for years that cancel culture isn't a thing. Meanwhile, like the numbers that we have of professors who have been fired,
yeah,
you know, the only thing we can compare it to is McCarthyism, where about somewhere estimates vary, but usually the solid number is about 100 professors were fired. Sometimes 130 is the number. We've had way more than that fired since 2014, and there isn't a national security crisis like there was in the 1950s. Like this, we don't have the normal reasons why people, you know, freak out and start firing professors for what they believe. So it's weird, like this altered kind of reality you see from Twitter, where it's always within the perfect rhetorical fortress. You have to have some technique that allows you to always win, even if you're wrong.
Being someone who has a large following on Instagram, I noticed that if I did one on COVID or thoughts about what was going on in the data on the vaccine, my account got completely dialed down. Like my reach got dialed down. I'd get shadow banned. You wouldn't be able to search my name. And it's noticeable. And to say that that doesn't exist, I'm like, okay. Like the gaslighting in that, it's like, just tell me it exists. Just tell me that it, just tell the truth. And I think that's the danger of even censorship is who gets to decide what is the appropriate message? Because
that is the problem.
Yeah, because I look at the fact-checking and all that kind of stuff from the last 2 or 3 years, and there's a lot of fact-checks that are now very true, and
absolutely,
they were true at the time. They just chose experts that didn't agree with the other expert.
And here's the thing, and this is chapter 2 of Canceling of the American Mind. I'm handing this in about
I can't wait to read it.
A month or two. I'm pretty pleased with it. It's an opportunity to say, pull a lot of the data in one place and say a lot of things. But the second chapter is all about, think about what you're doing to expertise and the value of expertise. And I think that one of the most harmful things that happened in 2020, which was a terrible year for freedom of speech, was what people would think of as the noble lie. So like a small thing that mattered a lot was early on in COVID when they started telling you that you didn't that masks don't stop the spread, but by the way, we need to hoard the masks for the frontline workers. And it's kind of like, okay, that doesn't even make sense. Either these work or they don't. And meanwhile, because this was being said by authority, I had people I love and respect very much being like, I can't believe people are wearing masks. These things clearly don't work. Who, you know, 2 months later were saying everyone needs to wear a mask. And it's okay to be wrong. I want to be really clear what I'm saying here. Being wrong about it is one thing, but when it's transparently someone lying for your own good, trust and authority is blown away. And there were many things that happened in 2020
so
in particular,
many,
but also since, that are devastating to people's faith in authority. And that's a dangerous situation for a democracy to be in.
Yeah, I see that for sure. Like, I don't trust public health anymore at all. Like, I don't believe anything they say. I don't trust my politicians in Canada. In the US, I certainly have mixed reviews too, but right. And I think people around the world are feeling that way because what you said about even the noble lie of the mask, like
the noble lie though.
Right.
Like that we will lie to you for your own good if it's especially important.
And we get to determine that it's important. And ironically, when they finally said wear a mask, they didn't recommend N95s and surgicals, they recommended cloth masks. So those were available when the noble lie was said. So that's what really blows up even the trust even further. But I don't think many people understand that distinction or that specific detail that really says, well, cloth masks were always available. They said turn a t-shirt into a mask. Why is this generally sourced or rising out of colleges? Like, what's specific about campuses and colleges and professors like getting canned? Like, why is that seem to be like an epicenter or a birthplace of this?
Yeah, well, I think it attracts I think it attracts a particular kind of mindset as part of the problem. You know, I've been writing this essay in my head called Fight the Guardians. And what I mean by that is the whole sort of like Plato's Republic, which I believe was him actually saying that this would be a utopian form of government. People claim that it's actually an allegory about the soul, but I'm like, no, I think he's actually saying that he thinks people like him should be in charge of everything because they're smarter than everybody else. And they can see the form of the truth, like the one eternal form of truth, and only really smart people can see that. And it's a mentality that's very common among intellectuals. It is very historically dangerous. And it's this epistemic arrogance that I talk about. Mm-hmm. And the thing about liberalism is it trusts more in sort of dispersed decision making. And even if, you're usually better off in a lot of cases taking the guess of like a thousand average people than, you know, certainly by going by the dictatorship of the smartest is going to, you know, definitely get you in a lot of trouble. But one thing that made it a lot worse, frankly, and it's something that I remember talking about this at Yale when I was pointing out like how little viewpoint diversity there is among professors and how much worse it is even among administrators. The massive expansion of the bureaucratic class at universities is overwhelmingly left-leaning and with a very sort of activist mentality that essentially like it's their part of their job is to sort of police what people say and to go after professors, like, you know, if they say the wrong thing. And this leads to an illiberal mentality that essentially it makes sense that they would turn on speech because they think they are the guardian class that can actually decide what should or should not be said. And if you really believe that out of yourself, then free speech is in your way.
Then diverse thought, diverse speech is actually in opposition to the sort of your
opinion. It's a threat to your expertise and authority.
Yeah, which then just reinforces everything. You know, it's just like it keeps feeding itself. And where college, when I went to college, I finished in 01. You know, there was a lot of diverse thought. And I'm curious, I don't know which way you'd like to start, but I'm curious, what is the benefit of free speech? Like, how does that actually make us as a culture better? And then what is the cost of not having it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think free speech has been the best tool in human history for innovation, wealth creation, understanding, and this is the least appreciated one of all, peace. Because inherent in the idea of freedom of speech is that the way we usually solve conflict in human history is frankly through violence or the threat of violence. And sometimes people call the founding of the United States, usually in comparison to the French Revolution, the conservative revolution. And I think that's just nonsense. It's a way of dismissing it. Because the First Amendment, in one sentence, the founders were trying to get rid of the reasons why Europeans had been murdering each other for centuries, that we will no longer – that everyone's free to their opinion, that everyone's – that the press is free, that you have freedom not only of religion but freedom from state-imposed religion. Those things together in one sentence, they tried to say these are no longer things we will be murdering each other for because everybody has these rights. So it's an incredibly ambitious idea. And what are the benefits? I think one of the most important ones that is not fully appreciated is simply understanding the world as it is. And this is the reason why I object so much to kind of the guardian class. There's this idea that the important thing is the form of objective truth, and then they can jump into, because objective truth is hard to know, therefore, if that's the goal of free speech, then free speech is not that important. It's a convoluted argument to begin with. But really, free speech, in a lot of cases, it's about knowing the little things. It's about knowing, you know, the price of wine in another city turns out is incredibly important. But also the fact that, you know, like this town two towns over from you is actually pretty mad at the mayor of your town is valuable to know. Matters of preference, matters of, prediction, all of these things, they come from a epistemically humble but distributed wisdom. That is simply impossible in a regime of top-down censorship.
So like where there's only a one way of thought or one that's accepted, you actually don't end up with the knowledge and wisdom that comes from, as you said, like if you were to pull 1,000 people on a decision to make, you'd make a better decision than to just pull 10 experts in the zone, you know?
Yeah.
Huh. So the bias that comes from it.
I mean, Hayek talks about, a great thinker of the 20th century, talks about just, you know, about the value of distributed knowledge and how we can't underestimate that. Meanwhile, people who believe in top-down societies really think that you can have this expert class that runs everything and the philosopher king will make everything better. And then there are simple aspects of the argument about human rights. And this is one of the things that I found so frustrating about the book, was partially because it doesn't take seriously the idea that around the time of the founders, people like Immanuel Kant were making the argument that free speech is, of course, a natural right that applies to people, that you'd have to rationally, to part of being human, that part of you is to tell your story, to explain who you are. And that even though there is a tendency among philosophers to sneer at the idea of natural rights, they somehow managed to also have appreciation for the idea of human rights. And it's like, well, human rights are natural rights. Like, there are assertions that every person is owed certain rights. And in the original version of human rights, freedom of speech was central to that.
What is the cost to us as a society then of not being, because again, when you were talking about this expert class that gets to decide, is there a both and too? That's what I was actually wondering. Is there like the embracing of diverse thought and that impacts or influences? Man, I guess the paradox of that is that the expert class has to be open to influence from.
Yes.
Which I don't know that exists.
You can have epistemically modest, you can have epistemically humble experts. And people actually, frankly, you know, and there's even research on this. Sometimes there's an idea, and you see this both on the left and the right, that you have to be decisive, that you have to show that you know everything and that you're utterly confident that these following 10 things are exactly what you should do. And it actually turns out that people are smarter than we're usually given credit for, and that if someone comes out and says, listen, here's what we know and here's what we don't know. What we're saying currently is telling us that this pandemic is going to, you know, go through this pattern or whatever, but we don't actually know. This is our best information. Those people are always come off as actually far more credible, partially because they're being realistic and people know they're being
open.
Meanwhile, as far as like undermining, you know, expertise, the showing certainty before you can possibly know something, before any average person can tell you that this can't be known, it really undermines respect for expertise. And where I saw that the most in early COVID was people going after the lab leak theory with the position of utter certainty that, like, oh, no,
can't
be true. That's nonsense. Yeah. And it's kind of like, okay, listen, I don't know if it's true, but I also know you don't know if it's true.
Right.
Because we all know there hadn't been serious research. Like, nobody did a massive investigation in China, and we know that. So how are you so being so epistemically arrogant here? And that immediately makes you like, listen, I'm not listening to you anymore if you're always this sure that you're right without even bothering to look into something.
Yeah, especially when you looked at the emails that actually fed the paper and the publication that were with Francis Collins and Anthony Fauci. You know, when all this stuff was happening, so much of the response, it might still be for someone listening right now, like, those are conspiracy theories. And it's like, they're not. Like, these are factual things you can look up and understand. And, you know, I agree with you too that I never thought about that. Like, if you exhibit or are so certain about something that an average regular person can even be like, no.
Yeah, you don't really know that. And I know you don't know that.
I don't like that too, because what you feel is the flexing of the arrogance of the expertise, you know? And I, as a pharmaceutical rep, I used to experience that a fair amount from the physicians that I worked with. And, you know, there were obviously really incredible ones, but there were ones that are like, this is just how it is, and no other specialists know, because I'm the one who did this or studied this.
Well, and to zoom out from COVID, think about, you know, the nutrition guidelines we grew up with. Unbelievably destructive, like the idea that we're supposed to be, you know, eating way more carbs than we should. That seems pretty but was that said with incredible certainty that, oh no, this is the food
fat's
pyramid.
Bad.
Yeah, exactly. And as far as like a full-blown disaster, you know, I mean, science getting something wrong, you know, lead, like leaded gas and leaded paint.
Oh, yeah.
I think possibly one of the great, like Haidt, even my co-author Jonathan Haidt, even thinks that might be one of the reasons why you saw such a increase increase in violent crime in the 20th century was a somewhat higher rate of lead poisoning, frankly. And there are lots of but as far as it being, you know, incredibly toxic and harmful, and what you have to do is see history and say, wait a second, every other period before this moment was wrong about something really, really important. It was actually wrong about any number of things. It was really, really important. What are we wrong about?
Yeah, and what's the cost of not allowing criticism? Because I know in a recent pod that I listened to from Jonathan, he was talking about how, you know, I think it was called like How America Got So Stupid in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And he was saying that, I think he was quoting his rabbi, who was saying that when you go beyond the binary of two opinions or thoughts, you inevitably find a third, and it is seemingly wiser than the first two. And I think that really, to me, spoke to the beauty of disagreement and diverse mm-hmm. thought and comic. Like, it would imagine, or if you look at history, is it not evidenced that disagreeing on something actually led to wiser decisions, breakthroughs in science, you know, all that kind of stuff, like Nikola Tesla, you know, like you think of the earth is round versus flat, although of course there's still people who believe it's flat, you know, like there's so many of these things that seem to be evidence that we are only benefited. Like, is the benefit of diverse thought greater than the people who are hurt by the freedom of self-expression?
Yeah. And the thing is, like, what's a greater hurt, you know, than being told that you can't tell your own story, that you can't actually share your opinion, even if it's wrong? And that's one of the reasons why it is understood as a human right. Salman Rushdie, you know, who was horribly attacked earlier this year, would talk about that it's a deep human need to be known and to be able to speak your mind. And if you ever talk to people who have lived in situations where they have to be scared to speak their truth, no matter how weird that may be, or in some cases dead on correct, as many of the dissidents, under communism, like Solzhenitsyn and Sakharov, that you never take it for granted again. And unfortunately, one of the things that was so frustrating about cancel culture, is just this idea that suddenly we're approaching everything with this level of epistemic arrogance, you know, that we know enough to tell all of these people shut up. Meanwhile, I do have a theory though on what's going on, and I talk about it as being like, it's like we're in 1521, and when I used to study Henry VIII and censorship during the Tudor dynasty, that was when Henry VIII first started cracking down on the use of the printing press, and he said that, you know, you can only print things that go through my royal stationer's company as a way of censoring, you know, what got printed in England. And I think that was in response to a legitimately tremendously disruptive technology that led to an increase in the witch trials. It led to religious strife and, you know, war and all sorts of conflict. And if you look at what the printing press was in 1521, you'd say this thing wasn't worth it. This thing was brought nothing but trouble. But if you take the long view of it, we just went through. So the printing press was adding, you know, millions of people to the conversation. I think it was something like there were like something like 12 million literate people before the printing press, and more than doubled, shortly thereafter. But social media just added billions of people to the discussion.
Wow.
And that there is no way that you can make that not a disruptive moment.
Right.
There's no top-down thing that Twitter could have done. There's nothing that Facebook could have done. It's unavoidably an anarchical period that's going to seem kind of crazy. But if we decide to give up on free speech, we lose the potential benefit of it. And here's how profound the benefit potentially is. One of the underappreciated benefits of the printing press was suddenly with millions of more eyes on any given problem, you had this distributed network of disconfirmation. Because we don't usually establish truth just by getting, oh, this thing is true. It's usually a process of chipping away at the things that are not true. So it's this a constant process of proving what is not true. Mm-hmm. When you have a billion eyes on a problem, and the potential, and this is going to sound very pie in the sky at this sort of techno-pessimistic moment, but there still really is a possibility of turning this distributed knowledge network into something that could be a huge boon to human innovation, human artistic flourishing, to human expression, to all of these things that make us better people, more advanced, that could advance society, that's still possible if we don't give up on freedom of speech.
I love that. I mean, that's the beauty and the hope that can come from this. I've never thought about the initial disruptive, painful nature of it and expansive nature because, you know, I think in a lot of ways, much like nutritionists coming in the world of the former food guide and disrupting that and all of a sudden saying like, hey, actually, fat's not bad and carbohydrates, Cheerios should not be higher on the rating than beef, grass-fed beef, you know, like it seems to that social media has in a way disrupted the expertise class too, because you have people with platforms and microphones that normally like a talent agent would sort or would never get on a television channel and be interviewed. And now prolific thought is coming from people that never would have gotten a microphone. And I agree with you on that. I think one thing that, although the last 3 years has been disruptive in terms of my beliefs and my naivety about the world, which I'm sure someone from a communist country would go, yeah, buddy. Like my sister lives in Mexico and part of the time, and she said to me, you know, the thing I love about Mexico is just how explicitly corrupt it often is. Like, at least in there, you know what you're signing up for. But in other countries, the corruption is systemic. And I'm left with hope too, because people that I know who never questioned anything are now at least saying, hey, we actually want more from the people, the elected officials, from our media. You know, I never thought that our mainstream media was so biased. Yeah. Now I'm like,
well, they've gotten more biased though. I mean, talk about being a college journalist and the shift from epistemically humble journalism, which is kind of like, listen, my job is to tell you what the world looks like as best I can tell. And it's especially important for me to report things that I don't like. Mm-hmm. I don't get to decide that. That's not my call. I serve a societal role that's bigger than me. To a, we want to change the world in a direction that's going to be positive. And I still listen to NPR, National Public Radio in the U.S., but particularly during COVID and for 2020 and 2021 in particular, when it seems really clear that you want people to come to a particular conclusion, they also stop trusting you. And I remember they were talking about the big stimulus package that Joe Biden had, not Build Back Better, not the big infrastructure one. And to be clear, I wanted infrastructure is something that I think should bring the parties together. But it was the much bigger one, you know, the multi-trillion dollar one that ended up not passing. And, you know, hearing someone on NPR, interviewing someone and saying, and actually, you know, the reporter taking back the microphone and being like, Joe Manchin not supporting this would be unconscionable, right? And it's like, hold on, dude. Like, you're not supposed to put those words in people's mouths. You're supposed to be able to, just because objectivity might be a standard you never quite get to, doesn't mean you just give up on trying.
Right. Do you find that social media has amplified the binaries of partisanship and even, you know, like the people who are free speech components, I think often it feels amplified. The people who are anti-free speech, it feels like there's more rage or like more anger at both directions.
I feel like I've hit a point in my life on Twitter that I'm better at walking away from it. I say my piece and I don't generally bother arguing on Twitter. I just don't think there's much of a point to it. And that might be disappointing sometimes for people, but whatever, I've got a life.
You've got a nervous system and a somatic experience you got to manage.
Well, exactly. Cause it's too engrossing. It's too, it can be too anger making and realize I'm like, why am I arguing with this person who didn't even like correctly read the thing? I wrote 180 characters and somehow they misread it. And I feel like I have to argue with this person. Right. I feel like it's gotten a little bit better, I think would be mind-blowing, you know, for a lot of people to hear right now because they're so critical in the Musk age. But I don't just mean like in the past couple of months. I mean, I feel like it's gotten maybe better over the last year or so. But I do think that there was a time when social media had this kind of island of misfit toys aspect to it where people could be as, you know, as weird and funny and people could be trusted to get that someone was kidding or being sarcastic pretending to say something stupid. And unfortunately, it got turned into sort of what I call a conformity engine, that essentially sort of like the people, the same sort of guardian class people who think that they should be the moral judges of all, became a little too empowered, and it became a place that actually fed partisan rancor. I still think it is doing that. I don't think it always has to be that way, though.
Yeah, I agree with you. I wonder, why is it that conservatism, or what would be even, it feels like what is considered right is anything right of the left. Like, I don't know, centrism doesn't even seem to have a home. It's just considered right wing. It seems like if you disagree with the perspective of pro-life, pro-trans, pro all that kind of stuff, all these sensitive subjects that have a lot of nuance. They have a lot, there's so much complexity. And that's why, you know, I'm not even giving a perspective on it. What I'm saying is that, like, it feels like the instant thing that you started off with saying, like the instant saying of something being conservative, like when did conservative become perceptually to what people might identify as left wing as being evil?
Yeah, I try to really own this on my own part, which is when I got to law school in 1997, I've very much a lefty, you know, like I said, worked at the ACLU, you know, like the, you know, went to Burning Man for 7 years, kind of like I was in like a lefty bubble. And I remember it was actually a gay progressive friend, who was definitely to my left, who was like, well, at a party, like, I don't remember what the context was, but he's like, well, just because someone's conservative doesn't mean they're wrong. And I remember having a little bit of like a, but no, that's what we're all saying. Like, that's what this entire community believes. So already in 97, labeling something conservative was a way to at least get people, even people like me, who absolutely, I'd go to court to defend conservatives' free speech rights. But that lazy intellectual habit of being like, but if you put that little tag on someone as being conservative, you don't have to take them seriously, has been on campus for a long time, and particularly in elite campuses. And of course, when something is that effective as a rhetorical tool that lets you win arguments, after a while, it just gets completely out of the box. And next thing you know, everybody to the right of Karl Marx is suddenly deemed a conservative, because then you don't have to listen to them. It's a very I'm going after that bad way of arguing in Canceling of the American Mind. Me and Ricky are really trying to point out these are not actual substantive arguments. These are BS.
Do you think there's an overlap or a correlation to how people who are involved in government, let's say, for example, White House, Senate, all that kind of stuff, tend to have sort of familial lines? They tend to, you know, be from wealthy classes.
Oh, the classism is all over this.
Yeah. So then it's also connected to the more elite colleges. So do you think it is that, like, it's that, you know, how you were speaking about this sort of specific expertise. And so there's a very narrow group of people all going through the same educational pathways, all reinforcing each other's power and privilege and power of their voice. Like the fact that their voices are amplified. I'm guessing now, and I forget where I was reading this, but how normally previously the media used to call out politicians and now they're at the same parties. So, you know, I'm curious your thoughts on the correlation.
Well, actually, they used to call out politicians and we're still at the same parties, you know, where it was kind of understood that they're not allies, you know, and that's more, I'm okay with them being friends.
Yeah, of course.
But you know, if they do something wrong, I'm calling you out. The fact that we get, and this is something that I got to experience firsthand, because I, you know, come from, you know, pretty humble origins, and then I ended up at a place like Stanford, and I was really, you know, I really kind of blown away to get in to be in a school that like that that fancy. I was a little bit horrified, though, at the extent to which suddenly I was considered so much smarter. You know, like it was way out of proportion to the actual accomplishment of getting in there, and it, being in these circles, the extent to which Yale and Harvard in particular matter to the lives of everyday Americans, I think is wildly excessive, particularly when you consider the fact that, what is it, like 45% of like white students at Yale are either legacy admissions, either or their parents worked there, wow, or they're for like the little, yeah, it's a large number. And so I talk about all these different ways that we could have a better, you know, a better country. And one thing is to be less, to bring too much of it, I'm going to sound Marxist, but too much of our ruling class from this relatively small number of schools. And I think about a lot of ways to do it. But the thing that I say, I keep saying that really makes people mad, and it almost makes me want to say it more, even though it's not usually my personality, but in this one is, and legacy admissions, because then maybe ruling class kids having to go to, I don't know, God forbid, state schools might actually disrupt the ridiculous concentration of power, influence, and wealth. I mean, between Harvard and Yale, Yale has, I think, around $40 billion just in the bank. Harvard has around $60 billion just in the bank. Like that's bigger than the GDP of like, I think I worked it out, like Lithuania, which is actually one of the richer Baltic countries. That's $100 billion, you know, just in investments on one side. Yale has more employees than it has students when it comes to administrators and faculty, almost as many students as administrators. Yeah, no, it's really out of control. And I keep on thinking about ways. Yeah, no, I think about ways to make this more fair and equitable. They talk a lot about equity, but I think that if you had some kind of like, I feel like we should have some kind of insanely difficult test, but anyone who can pass it gets a like prestige level bachelor's in liberal arts, because you need other pathways than the way too expensive, way too bureaucratized, way too ideological system that we currently have in the United States. Because I also think the fact that since they feel guilty for perpetuating these systems of privilege, it muddies the thinking about when you think from like a guilty perspective, you end up coming with also bad ideas. So I think that the extent to which higher education kind of distorts the marketplace of ideas in the United States is really quite profound.
Well, and it seems like even unconsciously, there would be no motivation to diversify how admissions are done. Because if unconsciously, at least, but also consciously, humans want to hold on to the status, the power.
Oh, even, sure.
Because I think of the irony of the left, which, again, I would have identified with, about the obsession with diversity, which, of course, is important. But diverse thought is also part of that. It's not just diverse of identity and race and gender and all that. It's diversity of thought. And gosh, this, like, if everybody thinks the same way and reinforces each other's thoughts, it's frankly, it would be really boring to be around them, because I love that people disagree. A lot of people disagree with things I say. And there, I learn actually quite a bit from being disagreed with. Like the other day, a friend gave me some serious feedback on a belief I had, and I was like, "Oh, yeah, that's very true." And it was just very helpful. It completely shattered a paradigm of something I couldn't see had I not been open to listening to her.
Yeah, group polarization, I think, is one of the most important sort of like findings in social psychology. We talk actually a lot about it. The minimal difference studies that essentially like you give someone like a red shirt and a blue shirt and how quickly they suddenly feel a lot more positively about the person in the red shirt for the dumbest reason possible. So we're very sort of tribal. We have a very strong tribal instinct. And we're doing so many things in higher education, in social media, to push people more and more towards their tribe. So one of the things we're going to be talking about is research that shows, or at least makes a strong argument, that, you know, cancel culture and social media is one of the reasons why you had this, you know, sort of right-wing backlash, you know, all throughout the Trump administration. Even January 6th is one of the arguments, because people don't stop believing what they think if you say that they can't say that on social media or kick them off. Actually, they tend to become even more convinced that they must be right.
Yeah, it amplifies it.
But even worse, it puts them in circles where people don't – since they don't change their opinion, they're just like, okay, I guess I can't talk to people who disagree with me about my crazy ideas about the lizard people. So I'm just going to talk to the lizard people. And of course, they just get more and more arguments on their side and become much more convinced that they're right. This is – a thought that's already was in existing constitutional law. It was nice to get to study a lot more social psychology with my friend John Haidt, because it's also a phenomenon that there's tons of research on. And meanwhile, like, we seem to be doing everything in our power to push ourselves into more extreme little silos where we see the other person as unconscionably either stupid or evil. which mm-hmm. is not a healthy situation
no.
ever, let alone for a pluralistic democracy.
Yeah, to instantly villainize. Again, there's that righteousness that protects our own perspective, you know, and it creates a hierarchy. And when there's a hierarchy, you can't see eye to eye. You don't respect the other person's perspective. So you're not going to learn from a perspective that you don't respect.
Oh, and I did want to add one thing into that. And one of the reasons why I loved working with John Haidt is that I had this idea from my own personal struggles with anxiety and depression that, you know, I was hospitalized in 2007 as a danger to myself. I was, you know, going to the hardware store to get stuff to kill myself. I was in a bad way, and it was partially the exhaustion and alienation of being in the culture war all the time. It really gets to you. And I, when I have other friends going through it, you know, I always say it's like, well, I'm glad I had my breakdown in 2007. So I got, at least I got it out of the way. But while I was recovering from that, I was doing cognitive behavioral therapy, and CBT is all about getting in the habit, and it doesn't work just knowing it intellectually, of talking back to the exaggerated, overgeneralized voices in your head and getting in the habit of speaking back to them that catastrophize, for example, that like if this little, if someone says something that sounds rude, you know, you can either go like, oh, well, maybe they just meant this thing, or you can tell people, obsess on it, figure out, do mind reading, engage in fortune telling, catastrophize. Yeah. If you feel bad, engage in emotional reasoning. And I'm kind of like, are we telling young people to engage in what are called cognitive distortions? Because if we are, and it seems like we are, that's going to make them more depressed. That's going to make them more anxious. And that's also going to be terrible for freedom of speech. And that was the argument I made to Haidt in 2014, even though my own staff was like, that's weird. That's a weird idea, Greg. I don't know if it's social psychology stuff or CBT stuff. And we made the argument in 2014 and then in our article and book in 2018. And the thing that horrifies us, and we really would have rather been wrong than see the absolute devastation that has hit young people when it comes to depression, anxiety, suicide, self-harm, mood disorders. And when people like try to dismiss what we're saying in coddling because they don't like the title, I'm like, because they'll fixate on it. Like, oh, you're just saying kids are spoiled. I'm like, no, I'm saying we're teaching them the mental habits of anxious and depressed people. So you should not be surprised that there's a mental health disaster.
That's powerful. Yeah, I know in coddling, you guys talk about how the perfect tool for especially a young girl in terms of bullying or managing their social or creating social anxiety and anxiety in general, because of how girls tend to deal with conflict and belonging or struggling to belong is through social means, is social media. And I had not considered how much that would amplify, you know, for me, having a social media platform and engaging in conversations on there, I started to witness a couple of years ago just the level of anxiety I was experiencing from, you know, in The Social Dilemma, they talk about how no one's psyche or body is designed to hear the opinions of 10,000 people, let alone millions of people.
And 24 hours a day for the rest of your life.
Right. And where someone will always be in opposition to what there will. Yeah. And cancel culture, I think, really heightened that, because what it reduced, even if it wasn't present in large quantities, it reduced psychological safety massively. I think social media itself is not psychologically safe in terms of self-expression. And not that I think you should be safe to have all your ideas agreed with.
Oh,
but that you shouldn't face social exile, which cancel culture threatened that to everybody.
Well, and here's the thing that I think that makes me saddest of all about this is how much it's messed with interpersonal trust.
Yeah. Speak more on that. Yeah.
A lot of times conservatives will ask me about safe spaces because they hear this term and they're like, I hate that term. And what does it mean? And my answer is always like, well, which of the 8 different definitions of safe spaces do you mean? If they mean, you know, when it's used like a sword, you know, like we saw at Yale with my friend Nicholas Christakis, where it's like, this is a safe space and you can't bring your opinions in here, then that's inappropriate. That's using your claim, your subjective claim of feeling, not feeling psychologically safe to censor other people. But if you're saying, you know, I have an affinity club where we were like-minded, that's fine. But the meaning that I like the most, that is what it meant when I was in college, was when you said, it's okay, it's a safe space. What you were saying was, you can be real. You can talk about difficult stuff. Nothing's leaving the room. You can trust us. And that's a big deal to be able to be like, to talk about really hard things. Like, you know, but people talking about whether it's abuse or like when it comes to the political stuff, talking about like, you know, like people will talk about their parents being bigots, you know, for example. But with the idea that kind of like this difficult stuff is going to stay among friends because we are friends and we trust each other, right? Or at least we're, even if we're not close friends, that there's an idea that that it's, I'm not going to go out and try to get you ruined. And kids are growing up in a situation where it's like, if I say the wrong thing and Hannah over there can put it on social media and she can get great points for calling me out because then she looks heroic. She has a moment of feeling, you know, like she did something good for the world.
Savior, yeah.
And it doesn't even have to be accurate, or it could be accurate, but it completely undermines interpersonal trust. And when you look at the numbers of these, how many fewer close friends young people are reporting as well, I think that some of this is, you know, frankly, cancel culture. I think it is this idea that if you have to be much more paranoid about someone ruining your life, you have fewer friends.
Yeah, you're going to have a smaller circle. You're not going to keep acquaintances. You're also probably not going to surround yourself with diverse thought.
Yeah, that too. And it makes polarization worse too. That's a great point.
The idea that you're, you know, when you were defining safe space, I think about in romantic or interpersonal relationships, familial friendships, the idea that I can't say something that's going to cause you emotional dysregulation, because if I do that, then I'm not being, I have to never say anything that causes you to get dysregulated. That's not a relationship I ever want to exist in, because of course, romantic relationships are by design dysregulating, so we can learn how to disagree and grow and hold two perspectives and honor both. Like, I don't think navigating a conflict successfully means agreeing. I think it means that both views can exist and that's it, you know, and we probably come to a third perspective that holds both.
It's another way that, like, spending a lot more time abroad and you know, growing up with a lot more kind of feeling a little bit like a foreigner in the United States was very helpful is that, and one of the reasons why Height and I are such good friends is that we both had a moral intuition when we were in elite circles that the way you're talking about, I always refer to this discussion with a friend in San Francisco, who would talk about how much he hated Kansas. And what he meant by that is he hated, you know, religious middle America. And I would point out all the problems with this. Like, one of them is kind of like, okay, so you hate them because they're conservative. You should know that, like, you know, half of them vote Democrat. Kind of like, so you can't dismiss, like, even if that's your dumb reason for not disliking them, you're also overgeneralizing. But at the same time, like, since I come from more of the international perspective, I'm kind of like, okay, this is what this sounds like to my ears. You know what? I hate Croatia and I hate Croatians. And it's like, doesn't that sound kind of gross? You know, like a little bit like you're overgeneralizing in a gross way. Because what I see is kind of like, yes, it's pretty typical that people in the cities are pretty hard on any country's, you know, religious minority. You know, like it's a dynamic that isn't actually exceptional. It is something that is pretty, but they don't see in some ways that they're acting like, they're acting like elites have always acted. And what I'd love to see is I think people might check themselves a little bit better on being dismissive on what people they don't like said if they had a better sense of what global opinion actually looked like. Not like, first of all, in the United States, but they could dismiss that of like, oh, those people are ignorant. But I'm like, you're also saying that everybody else on the planet is ignorant on this too. And that's okay to say, but you shouldn't say that without having a moment of being like, well, I guess maybe, you know, I don't think they're all stupid. I can't possibly think 99% of the earth is stupid and evil, right? Or maybe you could. I mean, I would be deeply uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, it wouldn't make for very much safety walking around, you know?
It's very epistemically arrogant, you know? Like, it's just kind of like, you know, I'm the one person who got it right in all of human history. Good for me.
Yeah, I think as a society, as a culture, this movement back to diverse thought just seems like a must. And if it doesn't, it feels like the systems will, if they get more magnified in terms of the singularity of their thought, the cost of that will, is that ultimately the path to dictatorships and tyrants? Is that ultimately where we go?
If you said something like that to me 10 years ago, I would have been like, oh, you're catastrophizing. Like, that's not, you know, that's not possible. It feels more like we're more in danger for the Republic. Actually, I was about to say that any time in my career. I would say actually I was more pessimistic about the fate of the Republic last year and the year before. This year, I'm kind of like, are we coming to our senses now? Are we actually starting to get back a little bit of it?
At the moment,
I'm feeling actually somewhat optimistic. I mean, I'll tell you, you know, like the Ukrainians fighting off Putin was something I never saw coming in a million years. And talk about something that made me feel like maybe we'll be okay, you know? Yeah. I talk about intermediated conflict in Coddling the American Mind. Haidt and I talk about it. And it's actually our friend Eric Horowitz. But he talked about how intermediated conflict, where essentially like if from K through 12, you're told that, you know, this guy bothers you, well, you have to tell an adult. Don't figure out a way to navigate it yourself. Then you get to college, you go, oh, this guy bothers you, go to the bias-related incident program and you know, call the hotline. Literally, there are actually hotlines to report on your friends and your professors if they say things that you think are biased. Then you go to corporations and you go to HR. The problem, there's a million problems with this, but one of them is that in a free society, we're supposed to be, at least in some legal sense, equals. If every conflict is settled by some higher authority, that's not thinking like someone in a democratic society. Right. That's like thinking like someone who's begging for the guardian class to be in charge of them.
Well, I'm curious, what is our way out? Like, what, how do we navigate this and broaden our own biases? How do we turn towards free speech or be advocates of it? And I'm guessing people listening are not, you know, some of them for sure. It's no small task, Greg.
Yeah, it's a lifelong. Well, actually, if you send me $19.99, it's a lifetime struggle. Freedom is always under threat. Freedom of speech is always under threat. Republics, the founders were very aware of the fact that republics historically did not last very long. And I think step one is not taking this for granted. Free societies have a incredibly positive, history if taken overall, if you have a good understanding of what the alternatives are. I think that Douglas Murray said it well, like when you hear people arguing about this being the worst of all worlds, it's kind of like always ask compared to what, because, I think that we are in danger of taking for granted what we actually have. I hope it doesn't take a calamity to make us even better appreciate it. But I hope that we get that there is something special about small L liberalism, the idea of sort of free societies, free trade of ideas, the idea of being epistemically humble, that your fellow democratic citizens have a right to their opinion as well, just as much as you do. Getting back there, Haidt and I are doing our best to figure out ways to do that. I do think that we need, you know, alternative ways of from K through 12 education up through higher ed that can do a better job of teaching people, you know, the habits of living in a small D democratic society. But it's like I said, it's a lifelong struggle.
Yeah, I definitely see a move away from academic education too. Like, there's the need for college is kind of becoming less and less because we can get specialized education in other places, depending on what we want to do, of course.
Well, here's the thing that just blows me away. Colleges still often have the temerity to say that tuition only covers about half the cost of educating a single student for a year. And you got to remember that in the United States, like Sarah Lawrence College, I think is only like $70,000 a year. And I'm kind of like, give me $140,000 and I will educate like crazy, and the first thing you do is like, here's the stack of books this high. It's one of the reasons why, like, figuring out some better way to do this, because right now when I hire from Yale's and Stanford's and Harvard's, because I mean, I learn a lot. I have about 100 employees and I learn probably more from being an employer than I learn from, you know, the books I read and from the law that I read. Yes, if you graduate from one of the fancies, I have a hard time not calling them fancies, you're probably pretty smart in high school, and you were probably pretty hardworking, and that's about all you know about them. Usually they know a lot about their major, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But you don't know if they know how to write. You don't know if they know how to think. You don't know if they understand anything about what the world actually looks like. You don't know if they know statistics. And everybody needs to know statistics. Like all of these things that should be considered sort of like the new liberal arts And I think that there are better ways to tell if someone is smart, motivated, and actually knows things than this ridiculously expensive system that we have now. I think about when we interview people for jobs at Fire, there was this idea that of edublocks, where essentially you could every time you read a book, you could pass like a little quiz on it and you get a little block saying that you read this book. Mm-hmm. Because when we interview people for Fire, we're looking for people who are one of us in the sense of like free speech is a passion of theirs. Right. And I know that like if you could actually see, oh yeah, of course I read those 36 books on this, you know, as opposed to someone who doesn't actually do this in their spare time, that would be a much better signal that we should be hiring this person than someone said, I graduated top of fancy school.
I'm curious, first off, thanks for coming on and sharing all your thoughts and your knowledge and your expertise and your experience. I'm, as I said at the beginning, I've been a super fan. And I just feel honored to be able to have this conversation.
Thanks
with
for
you
having
to
me.
Share. Oh, of course. And when your new book comes out, I'd love to have you back on to talk about it and share all your insights from that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. And for people listening, where can they find more of you and all the stuff that you're talking about?
Thefire.org. That's the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. We're doing a campaign on trying to get people to understand and appreciate free speech better. We're trying to reach, you know, 1 million people in the next couple of years. And our research shows, and this is something to make you somewhat more optimistic. Our research shows that right and left, there are a ton of people who still really care about free speech and free thought. And we're trying to identify the existing base out there to make sure that we're able to hand free speech down to our kids and grandkids.
Yeah, if it went with the same passion and tenacity that cancel culture has gone through colleges, which might actually be how it occurs, because of course, when we get to a place where people are reactive, it usually comes with that energy of rage and transformation. Yeah, so appreciate the work that you're doing and being such an advocate that I can say whatever I want on here with conscientiousness, of course. So appreciate you and your time.
Real pleasure. Thank you.